G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Harf. It is a good show. There are plenty of interesting people to talk to this morning, as is the case every day on the show, but also lots of interesting discussion points since we last spoke, which was less than 24 hours ago, across multiple sports. So it should be good fun, and it's very cold this morning, only 4 degrees. In the Melbourne area, we had a bit of sunshine late yesterday, which was nice.
It was magnificent. I took that opportunity. I got the opening of the sunshine, the window, and I got the dogs out there, and off we went, Whitey. Off we went in the sunshine. They had a ball.
Do you walk the dogs, or do they walk you?
No, it depends on the day. They're good-sized dogs, and they do a bit of pulling at times, and, oh, man. Yesterday was a bit of they walk me. The way home is always better than the way out. Like the front nine, if you put it in golf terms, the front nine's a disaster. I'm not warmed up, my swing's not in flow, and I'm just getting torn a new one by the course. The back nine, when there's a bit more fatigue at play, is when I come into my own. I really start to take charge, and my mental game takes on the competition and dominates. So It's a game of two halves, my dog walking experience. But yes, they're a bit big and they're a bit powerful. The bloody boxer, he is so strong. It's quite ridiculous how strong he is for a 10-month-old pup. My goodness. And that's the problem, because I'm the only one that can walk them when they're in that mood.
No, that is a problem.
I'm the only one that can get out there and sort them out. Right. So that is a problem in itself. But yeah, no, sometimes they walk me. Other times, they're actually lovely to walk.
Right. Well, it is meant to be an improving week to the point where we might see a 20 or a 21 a little bit later in the week. Yeah, Saturday I think it's going to be 21. But
really?
Yeah, it'll sort of gradually progress to that as the week goes on. So obviously from a coronavirus situation, we had a good number yesterday.
We did.
Well, it would be better if it was less, but it's going in the right direction. And there was certainly no real want to go anywhere last weekend. But so I think that helps keep the numbers down when people are staying inside because of the weather. But when we start getting 20s and 21s on the weekend, I think we're going to see lots of photographs of people at the beach and people in parks and all that sort of stuff, and people start panicking that people should be inside, but they're not. All these sorts of things as we go into a fourth week of level four restrictions. We're over halfway. It's fantastic.
Well, over halfway is very important because I'm just about at breaking point. Off the SMS, dogs are a darn nuisance. No, they're not. Dogs are awesome. Come on.
No, they're a darn nuisance. I agree with that text.
No. They're a fantastic addition to any family, dogs. Couldn't disagree with you more.
I'm not so sure about that.
Your dogs are lovely. They're little lap dogs. You can sit there on the couch and pet your dogs and they love you and all that sort of stuff. Not quite as manly as perhaps my dogs, but it's close enough.
I can't argue that. You've probably said something that's a little bit disrespectful to people, but I'm not going to argue with you, but at the same point, I don't really care.
No, well, that's the point, I think.
I don't really have a much emotional investment in my dogs because they're not mine.
Whose are they?
They're other members of the family. They just...
that reside in your house.
They just so happen to inhabit the house that I live in.
I'm a dog person. So I'm straight up, I'm very much a dog person. I love them. My dogs are fantastic. I love them.
Now, before we talk about other things in the world of sport, the obvious, the go-to, the default position is the football because it was on last night.
What happened last night?
And well, it was a win to Collingwood, but I tell you what, halfway through the second quarter, I don't think it was going to be a win to Collingwood. I'll talk to Rocket. I've got a few questions for Rocket after seven about Collingwood and about North Melbourne, to be perfectly honest, because it was a terrible game of football. What has happened to Collingwood?
That is my question. I must admit, watching it last night, who are these blokes? that have gone from such a slick unit. The first half of the season, they were such a slick unit. They're now really ordinary to watch.
They are.
But do you know what's happened? No, I don't.
You don't know?
I can't work it out.
Because the next person that talks to me about Collingwood's injuries, I'll spew up. Because they don't have that many. And for people that want to argue that fact, I'm happy to have it. Because I reckon there's only four out of their best 22 that aren't playing.
Oh, so this is the conversation we had last week about Essendon and their best 22 that had 15 out. Let's go through them. Oh, let's have a play. Yeah. Jordan Degowie is in their best 22.
Yep.
Jeremy Howe is in their best 22.
Yep.
Adam Treloar is in their best 22.
Yep.
Are you putting Ben Reid in there?
No.
Brodie Meyer, check your wool.
Yes. He's only missed 1 week.
Yeah. I'm just saying who is the current list. That's about it, I reckon, from the best 22.
And this is exactly right. And this is my point. Like, everyone talks about Collingwood's injury crisis, and there have been times through this year where there's been more than four out. But watching them last night, I'm thinking, remember that game in... Now, I know it's a long time ago, because it feels like 4 years ago, but they dismantled the Western Bulldogs back in round one and played an attractive brand of powerful football, moved the ball fast, slick, changing lanes, doing all the sort of things that we, to be honest, associate with Collingwood, because they can be such a dangerous side offensively. And then even against St Kilda in round three, the way they dismantled St Kilda. But that's it. They've just become this unattractive, dour, overcomplicated football team. And I just don't understand it. It's a mystery.
Joey, our intrepid producer, who's a nutbag, our Collingwood supporter, has just texted me and said, Tom Langdon.
He is.
No, he's a nutbag.
Tom Langdon hasn't played for 4 years.
He's fit. He's playing. He's just not in the team at the moment. So don't give me injured. He's fit. He's playing. He's doing scratch match activity. Joe, nutbag?
Yeah, said...
Joe. Yeah. He's not playing because he's not good enough just at the minute.
If it's 21 degrees or more, Joe will go to Collingwood games with his Collingwood sleeveless jumper on, despite being an adult.
I'm okay with it.
I wonder whether he sits on the couch wearing his Collingwood jumper.
You know I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm not.
Wear your colours. I don't care how old you are.
Anyway, I don't understand Collingwood, and what I also don't understand, and this is where just I think this season's just got to be a complete write-off. North Melbourne was 5 goals down, and North Melbourne was chipping it around in defence, 5 goals down with about 6 minutes to go. I didn't really understand that either.
Got to own the footy, you know that.
Oh, gosh.
Got to own the footy.
How hard are they to watch?
Well, the poor old Kangaroos. I mean, if you want to talk about injuries, well,
I understand that. But don't you think, though, when they can't make the finals, and they knew that going into the game, that they would perhaps be a little bit more aggressive and positive with the way that they play just to see what happens? And I've said that, you know, I think Sydney got into bad habits last week against Fremantle, but in general, Sydney have at least tried to do things a little bit differently, knowing that they're not going to make the finals. Yeah. I just thought that North Melbourne might have, you know, especially, you know, they were in front early in the game, and I don't think it was because of them. I think it was more because of Collingwood. But I don't know. I just thought they would have tried to scare Collingwood by actually scoring, as opposed to holding onto the football and kicking it around in defence and all that sort of stuff that frustrated me watching it. Anyway,
the first two goals and would have scared them, I'm sure. Oh, boy. That would have been interesting in the coach's box of the Magpies. Hang on a second. They kicked 2 goals against us here. 2 goals is a big lead these days. How are we going to get this back? But they found their way. Finished off in the second half with, 6 goals to 2. And won that game comfortably last night. Did the Magpies in the end by 30 points.
In fairness, they kicked away. In fairness, Collingwood did kick away.
They did.
And they did start to move the ball a lot better in the last quarter. Now, Whether that was because North Melbourne was fatigued, all those sorts of things, I'm not sure. But I think based on how they played last night, they're not beating Carlton this weekend, unless that last quarter there was something about it that worked. Krasner's on the SMSL. Let's talk about Essendon's injuries, because I refer to Essendon as being a team that has been ravaged by injuries. I stand by that. They have been, but I still don't like the way they're playing. I don't like the way they're playing at all. That's not going to win you many games of football. So
don't bring the Bombers up.
But Collingwood's a bit different because Collingwood's been a top four team now for quite some time, and they're just a shadow of their former self. And I whether the injuries have contributed to them losing momentum, whether it's and we've talked about this, that at training teams that can't work on their ball movement because of the restrictions. I still think that's one of the major contributing factors to the football being the way it's been this year. But perhaps make it less complicated and let the guys play and see what happens. That's just my view. I'm an old grumpy man.
That's grumpy old man sort of stuff, but that opens up conversations for jobs on the line sort of stuff. When you do that, if it's not structured and you can't paint that to the board and put that in your PowerPoint presentation, but this is how we're going to play and this is the build, and if you can't articulate that message, seemingly you never get a job in the world of AFL coaching at the moment. You can't do that. You can't just go in there and say, oh, we're just going to let them play a bit. I'm not sure that you don't get too many jobs at board level when you just go in and say, you know what, I reckon they're pretty good offensively, we're just going to let them play, see what they do, we'll put some shape around it. But unless you go in with a blueprint of this is every second of the quarter what we're going to be doing, it's a different world these days, the world of coaching.
Well, yeah. The last thing I'll say on Collingwood, and I shouldn't have talked as long because we wanted to talk to Rocket about it, but when Collingwood was a good team, particularly in that year that they led by 5 goals in a grand final, one of the great things about them was that they were very disciplined defensively and well-structured defensively, but when they got the ball, they had a license to take the game on and be unpredictable. And that was very, very effective. I don't understand where that's at, where that's gone. Because I remember talking to Taylor Adams about this on air a number of times. We're encouraged to think for ourselves when we've got the ball moving forward. We're encouraged to be unpredictable. We're encouraged to take the game on free of mind with ball in hand. Now, that's all the things that Collingwood's not at the moment. And I would really like to know why they've got to that point, because it was quite a successful template that they had. Anyway, that's it. That's enough for me on that.
Serena did win. She was playing somebody, Rus. Arantxa Rus. Is that the second Arantxa? Is that only the second Arantxa we've seen in professional women's tennis?
Since Sanchez Vicario. And, of course, what was... Yes, I was going to say, what was the famous thing about Arantxa Sanchez Vicario? I
love the little ball clip she had rolling on. That was fantastic stuff. Yeah, she did win that 3-6, 7-6 for Serena. So a bit of a tight one there for the champ.
Arantxa Sanchez Vicario had a brother that played. Can you remember his name?
Emilio?
Very good.
Yes.
Very good.
Good boy.
And
me.
Emilio Sanchez played in a marathon match at the Australian Open. Can you remember who it was against?
No, you're stretching.
On centre court?
Stretching the friendship now. I'll say what we're sort of circa about 90, somewhere there?
Yeah, around about that time, very early on in the days of what was then called Flinders Park.
Flinders Park. What about Mats Wilander?
No, it was John McEnroe.
Was it?
They played in a very, very long game on Rod Laver Arena. I'm not even sure whether it was called Rod Laver Arena then. Was it called Rod Laver Arena from the start? Or I've got a feeling that was a later...
It was an announcement.
A later thing.
Yeah, I reckon you're right.
I think it was just Melbourne Park or Flinders. It was definitely Center Flinders Court. Park, but I think it might have just been Centre Court.
I think it might have been just Centre Court. No, I don't know. Don't know. We'll Google that. We'll find that somewhere along the line. Now, before we roll, there was, as a Fitzroy supporter, you would have been in mourning yesterday with the sad news of the passing of one of the greats.
Yeah, absolutely. And his name is Bill Stephen. Now, Bill Stephen played a fair bit of footy for Fitzroy, about 150 games all up, but was captain of the football club, was a best and fairest winner at the football club, but was probably more known through his coaching because he coached Fitzroy on three different occasions.
Yeah.
He also coached Essendon in the late 70s, and some say was instrumental in sort of getting Essendon's successful era going when Kevin Sheedy took over in the early 80s, but he sort of gave some opportunities to some younger players at the Bombers in the late 70s. But Kevin Murray, who we've spoken to a couple of times on this program, Kevin Murray described Bill Stephen as Mr. Fitzroy just because of his love for the football club, his selfless nature. He actually wrote the words to the Fitzroy theme song. Yeah, he did it in a pre-season camp on a bus. He wrote the words to the Fitzroy theme song. But I had the pleasure and the absolute fortune of meeting Bill Stephen, and he's one of the nicest men you would ever want to meet. Gentle, use the word selfless, just a lovely man who is just so passionate about football, but particularly so passionate about the Fitzroy Football Club. And unfortunately, he passed away at the age of 92.
Yes, a very sad, a very influential figure through the Fitzroy days. And as you rightly say, I only coached the Bombers for 2 years, but people I've spoken to that were around at that time absolutely credit him with turning the mentality of the Bombers around as well. Sheeds came in and finished the job with that killer mindset, but Bill was the one that started to turn things around, they say. So a significant player in that club. In fact, Kevin Murray, who you talk about, last week joined the VAFA's Club in Focus podcast. They do a bloody good job, the VAFA, with some of their stuff. And Joey's involved in that, our little man at the back, our nutbag Collingwood supporter. He's involved the Club in Focus podcast. And Kevin Murray was asked to reflect on his time with Fitzroy and the link to the Roys in the VAFA. And he was asked about some of the most influential people he'd met across the journey. And Bill Stephen, funnily enough, was one of the first names that sprung to mind.
People that I played football with over all those years, they were like brothers to me, and you loved every one of them, and you had to have a special feeling for them. Billy Stevens was a great person for me. He gave me every opportunity, and he taught me well, and I learned a lot through when he was coach of the thirds and coach of Fitzroy Football Club. I learned a lot through all those people who guided you through the years of you being the one later on to be able to guide some of these younger blokes through as they come through at Brunswick Street or down the Junction Oval.
Well, the great Kevin Murray there with a tribute to Bill Stephen, who tragically passed away yesterday at the age of 92. So the football world was in mourning yesterday and will be for a little while.
Poor old Bill made his debut in 1947, so it was 3 years after Fitzroy's last premiership. We were talking about this last week. It was time to roar like 44 was the slogan of Fitzroy,
right,
sort of in the early 90s. And so he just missed out. And I say poor old Bill Stephen because Fitzroy never won another premiership. But he was still playing with, you know, 7, 8 or 9 Fitzroy premiership players through the early years of his career. So, you know, as I said, he played, I think it was 170 games in the end, but went very close to winning a Brownlow medal 1 year, played for Victoria. So, he was a very, very good player. But I still think he's going to be known more for his coaching. And he was coaching the day half that Fitzroy broke the record at the time for the highest score in VFL history. And the greatest ever winning margin of 191 points against Melbourne. So,
maybe you should have had him just guide the coaches of the modern era for a little while, just to work out how to kick big scores and win by lots. That would have been nice.
Well, do you think that they were chipping around in defence, just a lateral ball movement when they were 140 points up?
No, I don't think they were chipping around in defence with lateral ball movement, just maintaining possession. But I also think they had separate parts of the ground that they were sort of plonking themselves into as well. Perhaps they'd stretched the ground, Whitey.
They stretched the ground.
And the press wasn't perhaps as vigorous from the defensive team.
So that day was 36-22, 238 to 6-12, 48 at Waverley. So it was
Waverley,
a big ground. Do you think Bill Stephen would have had many forward pressure players that day that were and defensive forwards.
No. No, the more I think about it, the more the press has destroyed footy, isn't it? The press has destroyed footy.
Oh, gosh.
The forward pressure players. I wonder if they're wearing their ankle-high boots with long nails coming out the bottom, just trying to put pressure on.
It was 1978 or 79. It wasn't...
No, I know.
I
know it was 1922. Yeah. I'm just trying to paint a picture of him. Help a brother out. Yeah. No, I don't think... he was able to stretch the ground very well as a coach. He did a great job. That's what happens when you attack, though. People are nervous about you. They have to defend you.
You know what Bill Steven used to talk about? He said, boys, our defence is our attack.
That's right. That's exactly right. Old school. Old school from Bill. Very good from you. Very good. What else caught your eye yesterday? We saw a couple of appointments yesterday. We're speaking to Grant Brebner a little bit later on, which will be great in terms of the Melbourne victory. But Golf Australia made their appointment yesterday as well, Whitey.
Yes, so James Sutherland, who had been sort of mooted as the man that might become the new CEO of Golf Australia, that came to fruition yesterday. So I don't think he's necessarily going to start straight away, but I think it's a really interesting appointment. Obviously, someone with high profile that's had the experience of looking after one of the biggest sports in the country, arguably the biggest sport in the country because it's representative of the entire country, as opposed to, say, NRL or AFL that has parts of Australia.
Yep.
And he did it for such a long time. So his experience is going to be, I think, really valuable. But I think more than anything else, I'll be fascinated to see what his plans are. Because the thing with Australian golf at the moment is that there are so many outstanding golfers that are playing around the world. And there is a real appetite for golf at the moment, particularly through this coronavirus period, with so many people unable to play other sports, that golf became a sport for a lot of people through the last 6 months or so. So I think he's got an opportunity to really cash in. Well, not at the moment. But that's not a bad thing, the way how badly I was playing. It'll be interesting to see how he goes. But I still think, you know, there's a lot of positive things about golf, but you know, some of the negative things about golf is getting bigger tournaments in this country, finding a way to link into perhaps a European Tour or a PGA Tour into the future. So, very interesting appointment, that one. And Grant Brebner, we'll talk to Grant later. You know, you're quite close to the Melbourne victory. I like the appointment because I think he bleeds Melbourne victory, and we've spoken to him a few times on this program, that there's a bit more of a connection to the fans and what the victory actually stands for, as opposed to perhaps their last appointment. What are your thoughts on that one?
You know, I think that line of thought is very popular amongst the faithful at the moment. Certainly from within the club, my understanding is that they were keen for someone to be that figurehead for the club, and a history in the game, in the club, was important. Wasn't essential, because you know, if you can get bloody Pep Guardiola, you take Pep Guardiola. Like, if there's someone of that calibre that stands up and says, I'll do the job for whatever they're paying, then you take that person. But the element of familiarity with the competition, let alone the club and the supporters, and as you rightly say, the fans. He's always been very popular with the fans. He's one of the fan liaison sort of personnel from the club for a period of time as well. He gets the emotion attached to the Melbourne victory. He gets the connection between the fans and the club. And I think perhaps in recent years there has been a bit of a disconnect with that from the other coaches that have been in the role. But he will fully understand that. Now the challenge is to build a squad and manage it to a point where they can be competitive again, because as we've said a few times this year, and we'll talk to him later on, it's been an uncompetitive, disastrous season for the Melbourne victory. And we know it's been a hard year for everyone, but it's been a disastrous season for the victory on just about every front.
Yeah. I hate to say this because I'm going to contradict my own views on things here by saying this, but I think it's really important with the A-League that the figurehead, the coach, the manager, whatever you call him, is actually really good in the media. Yeah. And because there is a large element of PR attached to that person. And I contradict myself in saying you should always have the best coach as the person that is the coach. But if you look at you know, we speak to Mark Redan a lot on this program. Now, Mark was a great player, but also Mark spent a fair bit of time in the media. He gets it. He understands it. And we speak to him, and it's, you know, it's a really engaging conversation. And that was certainly the case with Grant when we've spoken to him previously. But then you get the Melbourne City situation where the bloke that's coached there, I can't even pronounce his name, he hardly speaks English. So, you know, I think it's part of the deal of, and it, again, I'm contradicting myself, but part of the deal is you've got to sell your sport if you're going to get traction, if you're going to get interest. But I think in the case of Grant Brebner, where he's got that additional attachment to the fans that connect, is really, really important. And I think that's across the board in Australian football as well. But
yep, I agree.
I think particularly in soccer when you're trying to gain some traction.
Ian Baker Finch knows all about that. He would have loved Kiss back in the old days. He would have loved rocking out the Kiss. And he joins us, Australian golfing legend. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Going very well, thanks. Were you a Kiss man?
Yes and no. I know, actually, they're mad golfers.
They are. That's right. Yes, yeah, they are mad golfers. They are. Have you played with them, man?
No. A couple of the boys here have, though. A couple of the guys I know are friends of a couple of them. I wasn't a big fan. I think it was sort of 10 years past my time. I was more a 70s guy.
Fair enough. Fair enough. You're more of a golfing guy. I tell you what, there's a bit happening in the world of Australian golf at the moment, Ian. We had the Northern Trust on the weekend from the PGA perspective. We had the Women's Open from the women's perspective, of course, over there at Royal Troon. Then we had Curtis Luck do some great things on the Corn Ferry Tour as well, get his first win on the tour. It's been a very exciting weekend.
Yeah, fantastic. Minji Lee played well to finish third. That was great to see her performing well in a major. And another Perth-sider, you know, Curtis Luck, getting a big win on the Corn Ferry. So that's good for him. You know, he's such a good player. It's taken him a little while to prove himself on that tour. And I think he'll be good and he'll get onto the main tour, if not next year, for full time again. But the categories are going to be strange next year, so it could be a little more difficult for him. But anyway, it was good to see him win and build the confidence.
And is it important for these guys to sort of go through a little bit of a trough? You know, there's quite a few examples of the young golfers that dominate amateur golf and burst onto the scene without, I guess, the pressure of having to earn a paycheck. And then they go through these troubles, but they sort of come through it. The good ones come through a little bit more resilient. Is it sort of part of that process, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. It toughens them up. You know, you look at young Ryan Ruffles. We all thought that he'd be, you know, beating Dustin Johnson by now. But I think the trials and tribulations and the knuckle-down effect, you know, the keep getting kicked in the arse and keep fighting back and keep getting knocked down and keep coming back, I think, in the end, if you are resilient, it makes you better long-term. And I think Curtis Luck as well, we thought he'd do a little better being such a high-quality amateur player. And, you know, that win will give him that little bit more of a spark. You know, some don't come back from it. You know, some of the young guys get a bit of a kick in the teeth and don't figure it out, unfortunately. But those two boys, I think, will be on the big tour soon and join, you know, Leash and Scotty and Jason Day and Cam Smith, you know, they'll be up there soon.
We want to talk about just the state of golf at the moment because we're obviously playing in very different circumstances to normal. But just your reflections on what Dustin Johnson did last week. I mean, he shot 30 under par for 72 holes. He's won a playoff event by 11 shots. This is extraordinary scenes.
Yes, he has an unbelievable weapon in that driver, you know, with the ability to hit it 330, 340 yards, you know, 300 metres every time in the fairway. And so he has a lot of wedges and he knows how far he hits every one of them, so he's very, very good with that part of his game. And he worked hard during the time that he had off on his putting, just standing around at home. He had to put a putting mat down from 10 to 12 feet and just for an hour a day just practiced his putting. And now he's come out with a really good putting game to go with the long driving and the great irons. So he's one of those guys, like Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, Tiger, of course, in his day, when they were at their best, they were untouchable. You know, they would win by 8 or 10 shots, as Dustin did on the weekend. There's not many guys that do that. A lot of guys need their absolute A game to sort of scrape out a win, and these guys can win with their B game, and when they have their A game, they win easily and win going away. It was really impressive to watch. I was in awe of it, actually. It was so good. Around that golf course, to be 30 under par, par 71, only 3 par 5s, was just amazing.
And one of those rounds for Dustin might have been Saturday. I'm not quite sure. You'll be able to tell me when he shot the 60. He was 11 under through 11. And I don't know if you've ever found yourself in that position, Ian. But I'm struggling to get 11 over through one. 11 over. What would that be like, knowing that you've absolutely brained the course to that point in time? What sort of sensation do you reckon that might be?
I can remember actually being 9 under through 10.
Yep.
And finishing 9 under, shot 63. I started thinking 59 and ended up parring every hole and couldn't make a putt. And I think that's what happened to him. He got it to 11 under, which is 60, 11 under on the par 71. And I think he started thinking, boy, you know, I could break the record of 58 here and make a couple more birdies. And with 18, it's almost a gimme birdie for him as far as he hits it. It's usually a drive and a 4-iron or 5-iron. I think he maybe just got a bit ahead of himself. But, you know, water flows off his back, right? He just doesn't get too perturbed about anything. And we ask him, and people, you know, kind of jab at him a bit, being a bit of an airhead. And I don't think he is. I think he's just an athlete that loves to work hard and go out and perform. And he doesn't let anything else really bug him or bother him, you know. So I really like his demeanour and the way he approaches things. I see him quite regularly here where I live. He and his brother Austin come and play at my club sometimes, and I get a chance to chat with him. And he's just an extreme athlete. You guys know what they're like. They're just so good at what they do, and they're so focused on what they're doing. And that's how he was that day. It's hard to say he was disappointed with shooting 60. but it's when you're on like that, when you get in that zone. Nick Faldo was trying to talk about that a little bit on Sunday, about how you just have to keep setting little goals for yourself. I remember once I won the New South Wales Open by 13 shots, and the last round I just had to keep setting goals for myself. Okay, let's be one under the next 3 holes. Let's be one under the next 3. Let's par these next 2 hard holes. You know, just set little goals and forget about the fact that I was winning by so many. And I think that's what he did. He just kept setting goals to hit the fairway, hit the green. He was shaping his shots well. It really was amazing, wasn't it?
I thought we played some really good footy tonight. 2.5 quarters. I thought we... everything went to plan. We executed where we should have. Collingwood, when we turned the ball over, they made the most of it, and they're a really class side, and they punish you.
That was Rhys Shaw after the game last night. They went down to the Magpies, of course, and he was pretty positive about the feedback for his players. Everything went to plan last night. Played pretty good footy, says our man Rhys Whitey.
I think Joey's made a mistake there. That must have been from a press conference from last year.
Let's have a listen to what Rodney Ead says about that, our coaching specialist and Coach's Corner on a Tuesday morning. Good morning, Rocket.
Good morning, Half. Morning, Adam. I must have been in a different game. I must have watched a different game. I was quite surprised when he said that. I saw that last night when he... And I didn't think Collingwood played that well. I don't think Nathan would have been extremely over the top about the way Collingwood played. There was just a game of mistakes. And certainly North Melbourne gave the Pies a good look at it. And probably, to be honest, I think Collingwood 2-1 by 8 or 9 goals. North played a slow, doer game, didn't they? Go to the boundary, go slow. Didn't have the skill to execute it, and in the end, it caught up with them.
So take us into the mind of the coach then, Rocket. This is, you've been there. You've done all this stuff. You've done the press conference after a performance like that. You've had a team that perhaps not too much has been expected of. Perhaps up there at the Gold Coast Suns, not coming through, emerging, learning. They've got a really developing team, a lot of injuries at the moment. Is that a coach who's just trying to soften the blow for the players, or is that for the fans, that message?
Oh, a bit of both. I think he's already spoken to the players, so he's already probably given that message. So it's a bit to the fans. I think it's also probably with their injuries and whatever, not really thinking that they're going to win. So let's have a plan going in. They had a plan. So from his point of view, they probably executed as much as they could for that, which was take the speed out of the game. They're not a quick side. Let's frustrate Collingwood, a bit like what they did about Brisbane last week. But unfortunately, they've made too many turnovers.
Well, speaking of coaches, just as we'll digress just for a second, some breaking news. The Philadelphia 76ers have fired coach Brett Brown. Sources tell ESPN his dismissal is expected to be a precursor for more upheaval from the 76ers. Still owed several million dollars on the remainder of his contract. We're going to follow that up. But Brett Brown had been sacked by the 76ers. Not a great time to be a coach in professional sport at the moment, Rocket.
No, there's going to be limited jobs. I suppose there's always going to be the head job, but the head coaching job. The assistant coaches in the AFL are probably what you're leading towards. There's going to be a bit of carnage around, isn't there?
Well, there is, and yesterday there's a lot of carnage at head office, as well as up there at the Gold Coast Suns, who I think parted ways with five. Coaches of sorts, Rocket. There were some development coaches there, but assistant coaches, and the big one is Dean Solomon. You would have worked with Solly up there at the Gold Coast, wouldn't you?
Yeah, Dean was there from the start, so he's been there the whole time, so 9 years or 10 years or whatever the case may be. So, yeah, it was a bit of a shock. I think as much a shock with him being on that list is that he signed a contract last year to go to the end of 22. So for the Suns, who are heavily backed financially by the AFL, really, to actually have a payout of whatever that's going to be. Some people say it's north of $500,000. So it's a lot of money in this day where where clubs and the AFL have lost money to be able to do that. So something's happened. I don't know what, but obviously something's occurred that they've now they've seen fit to part ways.
He was always a popular member of the Essendon Football Club as a player, real player's player, just loved by everybody. And he seemed to have a reputation up at the Suns as being someone that was very popular with the players there as well, in that sort of connection between the players and the coaching group. What were your experiences of Dean, and what was his strengths?
Yeah, I think that was his strength. There's no doubt about his ability to connect with his group of players and have a relationship with them. So I think what was seen at Essendon is probably the same that was at the Suns. So I'm not too sure where that sat in the last year or two that's caused the Suns to split. I don't know. So there's not many reasons that you can think of that would occur for a club to do that. Is there really, when you look at it, if he's doing a good job, which they're obviously by association have said that he's doing that by giving him a new contract. So it's either something off field, which hasn't come to light, so that was the case, not doing his job properly, which you'd find, I think, hard to believe. Whether it's a trust factor from the coach, I don't know. There's something that's occurred. I find it strange. So I think, you asking it, and I heard last night some TV stations were asking it. So I think there's going to be more questions of the Suns. It'll be interesting to see how they answer it.
No, I'm with you. There's going to be a lot more questions of the Suns. We know that there's a squeeze on soft caps and footy departments and revenue streams and all that sort of thing in all clubs, and there will be more of this going on. But the timing of it, the fact that a couple of these guys are in contract, and it's going to be around about, they reckon, $800 to $1 million payout, Rocket, for these guys. On the day that the AFL shed 30% of their staff or whatever it was yesterday. It was a very unusual timing. None of it seems to make sense. Solomon was the main sort of name out of that, but Nick Malcheski also had a couple of years on his contract to go. Actually, Prescott's been up there for a while. Andrew Swallow, of course, we know has been up there, is involved for a little while. Justin Kaczynski as well.
Sean
been
Hart.
Told to find new clubs. And then there's Sean Hart, yeah, who was the welfare officer, wasn't
they
he?
They went and recruited from Port Adelaide. So, but I think them and Freo are the first two clubs really that mention it. Now, it's going to happen to all clubs.
Yep.
And I've heard that the interesting things for me will be teams that are in finals contention or even top four, I'd say premiership contention, they're going to have to shed some coaches because it is going to be a fact of life because they've got to shed $3 million. So there's going to be some coaches go. So teams that are in hubs, so it's okay for the Suns and Freo, they're not going to make finals. The teams that are going to make finals, what are they? How do they tell these coaches if? And they're going to want to know because they're going to be upset about it when they get the news. But at the same time, they would rather the news now than in October because they've got to be able to look for employment. So it's going to be a balancing act for Port and Brisbane and Richmond and these teams, West Coast, these teams up the top, when they tell their coaches, because they can't carry 10 coaches anymore. The Suns have got rid of five. Most teams will get rid of four or five coaches, and that's a fact of life. But how you tell them and when you tell them, interesting dilemma those clubs have got.
Yeah, so Fremantle announced on Monday that Anthony Rock, Michael Pryor, and their strength and conditioning coach, Jason Webber, will all have to look for new employment opportunities in 2021. So you're right, it's coming. All this information is coming. Well, the timing from a club that's essentially funded by the AFL was most intriguing yesterday from the Gold Coast Suns' perspective. They've got a bigger list of players, though, with probably necessary to have more coaches. Rocket, is that your experience as well, or has that been recent years?
I think they've added Swallow and Kaczynski were both part-timers.
Yeah.
Sean Hart was in the welfare area or the player welfare area. Generally, most teams will have 9 to 10. Now, used to, before the soft cap came in, some clubs have 12, but it's about 10. So it'll be interesting to see what number they land on for clubs. I couldn't see them having more than 6, so maybe 5. And other areas, recruiting will get a cutback. The IT section will get a cutback. Strength and conditioning, the high performance area will get staff will get cut back because they've got to cut $3 million, which is a lot of money. And so not only staff, there'll be other things. We just cut back to basics.
So what format did you like with your coaching staff? What worked best for you? And it's obviously different for everyone, but I imagine there's a lot of coaches out there that give a lot of responsibility and control to their assistants and development coaches through the week to run the program, and they sort of oversee it and come in when they need to. What was your preferred lineup and format for a coaching panel?
Well, it's probably not as spoiled for riches as numbers compared to a lot of clubs. So the Bulldogs didn't have a lot of money, and the Suns didn't originally. I know at the end of the second year, they asked, what would you like? And I said, well, you'd like another couple of development coaches. A, the list is so young and just didn't have as many, probably had 6 coaches maybe. Went to 8 or 9. So you'd like to have a line coach each and yourself. Some teams go for a senior assistant coach on top of that. I don't know whether that's the right way to go. You probably have a head of development and probably have 2 to 3 other development coaches, probably particularly aligned to a line coach, so back, forwards, mids.
Yep.
So what are you looking at? 8 or 9, probably in that case. You know, some teams have got 10 to 11.
Do you think it's too many? Do you actually think it's got to the point where you had them because you could have them, or do you think it's actually necessary?
Oh, there's no doubt they got to that stage. And I think the soft cap drew that back a little bit. It was a bit of an arms race in many ways. So the teams with money for a not-for-profit organisation were having a lot, so they'd actually spend it. I think you'd probably need a line coach each, so that's 3 senior coaches, 4, then probably a development coach. So probably 7 you could get away with, I reckon. But they're going to have to cut that back further. So it's going to be coaches now, not only senior coaches, but other coaches, are going to have to multitask. They're going to have to do two and three jobs.
Let's touch base now with one of our favourite T20 cricketers on the planet. Ben Dunk is his name, and currently he is in the Caribbean Premier League playing for the St Nevis and Kitts Patriots, and he's on the line. Hello, Ben.
Good morning, guys. How are we going?
We are very well, thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. What's life like in the CPL currently, considering the climate on the world and how things are across the planet? How's things in the Caribbean Premier League?
Yeah, look, it's certainly different to when I was here 6 years ago. You know, 6 years ago it was one of the great tournaments to go to. You know, hopping around these exotic locations, playing a little bit of cricket. Whereas this time, as you know, you can certainly expect with the current climate around the world, it's a lot different. You know, we're holed up in our hotel rooms and can't go outside of the hotel. I guess you could probably call it something similar like the AFL bubble is sort of what we're sort of stuck in at the moment. But at the same time, you know, we're pretty fortunate to still be able to play cricket and earn a living and do what we love when, you know, so many other people are doing it a lot tougher than what we are.
Yeah, so it's nice to have a job and be able to do what you do, which is fantastic. But I imagine part of that experience, particularly travelling around the world to play in those T20 comps, is to embrace the theatre of all the different cultures and cricket lovers across the planet. I imagine it's very different when you obviously haven't got that level of support or level of energy in the stadiums.
Yeah, 100%. You're 100% right. You know, one of the great things about these leagues that, you know, you go across to all these different places around the world. A, you get to see, you know, places that you wouldn't normally get to see. And then, you know, you just get to see how much the sport and the game that, you know, we all grew up loving is loved by so many people around the world. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's no one in the stands. You know, there's limited sort of interaction with any kind of, well, there's no interaction with any kind of fans apart from sort of on social media or all the rest. But, you know, this is probably the way it's going to be for a little while, so it's sort of a matter of trying to get used to it and cracking on and you know, actually doing your job and getting some runs.
So in regards to what you can do outside playing the game and also, as you said, just staying in your hotel room, are you able to have many training sessions? How is that compromised if you are, to make sure that, you know, you're getting a hit in between games? What's that process like?
Yeah, look, that's probably been the biggest challenge. You know, when I left Hobart in the start of, or the end of July, sorry, it was snowing. So, I certainly wasn't training outdoors. I had a couple of, you know, indoor sessions, and then we sort of got over here and then we had to do our 2 weeks quarantine, like hard quarantine in our hotel rooms, which was, you know, I understand at home you still get, you know, the hour or whatever it is outdoors to do some exercise. That wasn't available to us here. It was just literally stuck in your room. So you had to do a little bit of physical stuff in your room. And then once that 2 weeks was up, we had a three-day block where we could then train to get ready for the first game, which was essentially on that fourth day. But unfortunately for our team, it's pretty tropical weather here at the moment. So it's, you know, it's raining. Isolated rain throughout the day. Most days it just comes and goes within the space of an hour. But our team, unfortunately, happened to get those days or those time slots where the rain fell, and so we had one training session leading in, which was, you know, one of the biggest challenges so far. So we've had a bit of a slow start. We're none from three, but you know, we're certainly showing signs that we're getting there.
So, Ben, did you have any hesitation at all about going? Was there the thought of staying at home? I mean, you're the modern age cricketer in a sense. You sort of you're a gun for hire. You freelance around the world. But was there a thought of this? I'm not sure about this.
I guess there was. To be honest, I've been pretty lucky and sheltered, I guess, from the whole thing being down in Hobart. You know, when I got back from Pakistan in the end of March, we had a month-long sort of lockdown period. And then from that on, we've been relatively free of the coronavirus. So, you know, life's been realistically quite normal down there, you know, going to the pub and watching the field on a Friday night and all of that sort of thing, which is in stark contrast to, you know, what it's like being certainly in Melbourne and most parts around the world. So I must admit, I was probably a touch naive around it. And then once I sort of got to Sydney on the way and saw, you know, the airport, the scenes at the airport, no one around. It sort of sunk in a little bit more, you know, the magnitude of what I was sort of taking on. And, you know, unfortunately at that stage it was probably too late. So 3.5 days later, in terms of travel, I arrived in the Caribbean. And, yeah, like I said, though, I still think I'm reasonably fortunate, you know, well, very fortunate to be able to do what I love and you know, earn a living while I'm doing it. A lot of people out there, it's certainly very tough, and if they had the opportunity to do it, I'm sure they'd take it on.
Jamie McLaren is the Golden Boot winner in the 1920 Hyundai A-League season. Plays for Melbourne City, of course, and he's getting ready for a final tomorrow night against Western United. He joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning, guys. How are we doing?
We are very well, thank you, pal. Appreciate your time. We've spoken to you a couple of times in the last season. It's gone forever this season, of course. But the Golden Boot, you awarded the other night, 22 goals for the season, which was an outstanding achievement. Do you chase those little markers along the way, or are they just the byproduct of all the hard work you put in?
I think from an individual perspective, you do chase it. Obviously, there's fantastic strikers all across the league in different teams, and they're all foreign players. And, you know, I'm probably the only striker that's Australian. So I take pride in winning that award. I won it at Brisbane Roar a couple of years ago, and it was a great feeling. And to win my second for my hometown club was special this time around. And at the start of the season, you set goals, and that was one of them, definitely.
So you come into the last game against United, Western United last Wednesday, I think it was, and you're even on the top of the table. So what's your mindset going into that game? Are you just doing everything you can to try and get on the end of one?
You know what? Probably first up, I was trying too hard or making things happen that shouldn't have in our structures. But that was just me being desperate to go out outright on top of the Golden Boot. And at halftime, I took a deep breath and spoke to a few of the boys and just said, look, you know, just get it in the area. And you saw my second goal, Lachlan Wales put a ball fantastically across the box. And yeah, that's what I do, my work inside the six-yard box and put it home. But even penalties, you know, I pride myself. I haven't missed a penalty this year, and I feel as if I've been working on those as well. And, yeah, I work so hard to score goals, and I feel like the harder you work, the luckier you get.
How would you describe, Jamie, the form of the team sort of coming out of lockdown or coming out of the break? Do you feel that you're playing better than you were before the break, or you've been able to just carry on this momentum? Because overall, the season's been very good.
Yeah, it's been great. I think post-COVID, we've probably played very similar, but I feel as if we're playing a bit hungrier. And that probably sounds a bit silly, but I think we're not taking this game for granted now. And we know how close we are once final series come around, that, you know, one-off games, you could be going home or you could be sitting in a grand final. And that's something that this club hasn't done. They haven't been in a grand final before. And you know, I'd take massive pride, and I'm sure my teammates as well would take huge pride in going into a grand final for the first time for Melbourne City. And that's something that's pushed us since we were able to train as a team again back in July. And since then, we haven't really looked back, mate, and the squad are so confident.
We've talked a lot on this program, talking to athletes who feed off the crowd. They need to get excited to play at their best, whether that's Australian football, whether it's cricket, whether it's golf, doesn't really seem to matter the sport. What about you? Because you love the big occasion. You love the pressure on you to perform. What's it been like playing in front of empty stadiums?
Yeah, I mean, you can't beat having a full stadium. It is taking a bit of zap out of the game, and it's unfortunate. Obviously, we'd love to play in front of our fans. And look, I love playing against, you know, away fans that hammer me for 90 minutes. So it's a different period, and I think no one's really enjoying playing in front of nobody, but it is what it is. I believe that potentially there could be some faces in the crowd tomorrow night and potentially in the grand final, and that's great for our game and great for people at home watching it, because it just brings more atmosphere and it gives you that lift.
There has been a bit of a change in your world, though. The skipper not coming back, Scotty Jamieson, who's part of our team here on The Breakfast Club. We speak to him a lot, and he's decided to stay home with his young family. Obviously, a leadership void is left on the back of that. Do you step up into that?
Yeah, obviously, losing Jamo was a big loss in terms of that leadership. He's a quality player and obviously a great leader. And no player begrudged his decision to stay home and look after Vic and the baby. So we support him fully, and you know, boys like me and Josh Berlante, Roston Griffith, all the boys who have been around this league long enough to know that you do need your experienced heads to calm the ship, and Josh Bellante stepped in as captain fantastically. And me as a striker, I sat down with the coach and said that I didn't really want to be involved with being the captain with the armband because I need to be solely focused on scoring goals. And that was a great decision by the coach. So I'm here to do the sort of work, you know, under the radar and just fly with the young boys and just try and pick them up for great occasions.
Speaking of coaches and pressure and payouts, Danny Widler is the chief NRL reporter with Channel 9 and joins us for all the latest in the NRL. Does a great job for us, and he's back again. Danny, good morning.
Morning, gents.
Now, I started that with the Brett Brown news. What's the situation with Anthony Seibold at the Brisbane Broncos? Because there was some unbelievable feedback from one of the part owners last night, which you spoke about on Twitter. This is from Phil Murphy, one of the private shareholders of the Broncos. It's like having a cancer and it's not been cut out. If you don't treat the cancer, you die. And I don't want to see the Broncos die. Now, he's referring to Anthony Seibold. What the hell's going on?
Look, this character is a part owner of the Broncos. I think he owns 22%. And he's often neglected by the Broncos in any decision-making process they have. And obviously, he's peeved with everything that's gone on. I think he's chosen his words particularly badly. But the message that he's trying to get across, obviously, is that Seibold has to go, and he is going. He just said it in a very poor way, in a disrespectful way, and one which I'm sure he would regret.
Yeah, that's a horrible, horrible message to be sending, regardless of the position of the club or the tenure of the coach. It's a horrible thing to do. So is he a you say he's sort of in back scenes from the decision-making, but is he a prominent NRL person?
No, but he is a 22% owner of the Broncos.
Yeah.
So he probably would like to be, given the amount of power he's got at the Brisbane Broncos club, but he's largely looked over in a lot of the things the Broncos do.
Right. So the Seibold situation, he's on the way. When is that happening?
Well, Anthony Seibold has rocked up at Brisbane HQ today. He's out of his COVID situation and he's turning up to work. Obviously, though, the days and hours are very limited. He has been offered $1 million by the Broncos to go now, and they're saying, well, if that doesn't get taken up, they're just going to sack him. Then things will get ugly. Look, I think Anthony Seibold's probably got about $3 million owed to him on his contract, or around that figure.
Wow.
And I can understand that he's digging in if he's only going to get $1 million. When I say only, I mean that's a lot of money, but in comparison to what his contract says, it's not that much money. I think they'll come to some kind of settlement, hopefully in the next few hours, maybe 24 hours, and the terrible reign of Anthony Seibold will be over, because it's been a very poor coaching reign. There's no way to sugarcoat it. The Broncos are at their worst point in their history as a playing group and as a team, and Anthony Seibold is going to have to pay that price. But however, I don't think he should be alone in that situation, because the people who appointed him to this very poor deal really need to be made accountable as well. And I'm talking about board members, chairman, CEO. They should probably follow Anthony Seibold out the door.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Too often, the people that make these calls and then act on them very, very early are let go and just allowed to continue on with their positions. But just we were talking before about the purge in the AFL at the moment, Danny, with footy department caps and spending opportunities, and the fact that there are now coaches being told they won't be involved next year at sort of assistant level and development level. So there's no money in the game. Is that the same in the NRL? The clubs feeling that same level of financial pressure just due to the current climate?
No, it's worse in the NRL.
I know that
the situation's not great, you know, and I think that the paying out of coaches across the board is a real issue for the game. It's pretty irresponsible for clubs to be putting themselves in that kind of situation. And I mean, we're talking, you know, with Seibold, $1 million, millions of dollars. It's
yeah,
a lot of money in this situation. And when people are losing their jobs, obviously in society, but also throughout the game of rugby league, and it's not pleasant. I think there are going to be cutbacks in rugby league as well coming up. So it's a very delicate situation.
Dylan Scheel is one of the key playmakers of the boys in the red and the black, and he joins us on the program this morning. Good morning, Dylan.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. How did you recover from Saturday night? Was it sweaty up there at Darwin?
Yeah, it was super hot up there, and obviously something that I'm not used to, considering playing a lot of footy south of Australia. So had to keep pretty hydrated during the night.
I saw the Richmond boys were using the fridge sort of setup. They jump into the big cold room. Were you using that as well?
Yeah, we had our quarter time and three quarter time breaks in the cool room, so we were certainly utilising that.
What's that like though when you're going from hot and sweaty into that cold air for 3, 4, 5 minutes, whatever it is? Does it rejuvenate you, refresh you, or is it just nice to get out of the heat?
Oh, absolutely. It's like stepping out of a sauna and jumping into a cool ice bath. It's just nice and refreshing, and certainly need it when you're playing up there.
Have you played in Darwin before, Dylan?
This is the second time I played there. I played a NEAFL game in my first year at the Giants up in Darwin. So yeah, but it was about 9 years apart.
Yeah, so explain to us, if you've got the details, how much weight would you lose from the start of the game to the end of the game, and even from a hydration point of view, preparing for it and then post the game, just to get yourself back to some sort of normality?
Yeah, so obviously depending on how heavy you play at, but probably like if you're playing in Melbourne or Sydney, those sort of conditions, yeah, you might lose around, 1 to 2 kilos or litres of fluid from a game, but up in Darwin it's more like 3, and guys could be losing 4+ litres of fluid, so super, obviously the hydration is super important post-game, just so guys aren't remaining dehydrated, and hydration is a massive part of your recovery, so it was a big focus for us the day after the game.
And just for those playing at home, Whitey, if it's over 3%, it becomes dangerous, can become dangerous, 3% of your body weight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's just and I'm very ignorant on these sorts of things and very naive on these sorts of things, but is it as simple as putting in 4 litres of fluid that you lost? How do you sort of monitor trying to get yourself back to normality quickly? Because the reality is you play this Thursday night against Hawthorn, so it's a quick turnaround. What are the sort of things you're doing?
Well, the general rule is for every litre of fluid you lose, you need to put back in 1.5 litres of fluid into your body. So, I would say that, if someone's losing 4 kilos of weight from a game, it's not going to be four litres of fluid. It's going to be a lot of energy that's been burnt from, consuming food and things like that as well. So unless you have, do an actual sweat test with, devices that measure the amount of fluid that the body is losing, then you can't accurately, say, this is how much fluid that needs to be put back into a certain athlete. So, but, you do get a general sort of feel just off experience and how you're feeling, in the days after the game. I mean, if you're thirsty, drink more water, I guess.
Yeah. So, and is that what it is like? Is it sports drinks? Is it just pure water? What are the sort of things, is it particular fruit or food that you eat to get yourself, back? Because that's quite dramatic to lose that amount of weight in only a 2-hour period.
Yeah, the first sort of hour or so is really important for the body to get some food into it that's easily digestible. So a lot of the guys have things like flavoured milks or protein shakes that are easily absorbed by the body. And then back at the hotel, we'd have like a dinner, because when you're playing at night, you don't really get to eat dinner prior to the game. So a lot of guys haven't eaten, the last meal is at about 3 p.m. for a 7 p.m. game. So we'd get back to the hotel and have a late night dinner, and guys are sort of refueling with, good carbohydrates, good meat. And I'm sure there's a few guys that like to, including myself, that have a bit of a splurge on some lollies and things like that.
Be rude not to, I reckon.
Fascinating. Lollies are good. No, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Take us into the review from the game on the weekend. because we were talking a lot on, what was today? Yesterday it was, about the situation where you get the ball inside forward 50 24 times for the game against the Tigers. Was that more them? Did that say more about them or say more about you, Dylan?
About us kicking the ball only 24 times?
No, sorry, 24 times inside 50. 24 inside 50s for the night. Is that more about their pressure and their defence or your system and play?
Look, we're still growing our game and trying to, you know, improve it week by week. And we're coming up against a team that's, you know, been playing their way and been the best at the comp at playing their way for a number of years. So it's a combination of both. I mean, they're the premier team of the competition and one of the best teams that are, you know, pressuring opposition when they've got the ball. So, you know, it's a combination of that. They're a super team to watch. And then when you're playing against them, it's, you know, it's first class with, you know, the way that they're connected all around the ground.
So can you feel that when you're out there during the game? Can you feel it gets really hard to move the ball with any sort of flow? Can you understand that when you're out there?
Look, it's probably, as a player, it's hard to, like, understand and, you know, analyse in the moment. You're just sort of seeing it and feeling it and asking questions to the coaches who have, a bit of a bird's eye view from the coach's box on what's going on. But, you know, we do plan for it. You know, when you watch a team for a period of time, you get to see how they play and you can anticipate the way that they like to defend and attack. So, but when you're out there, it's a different story on how to execute it.
So what was your assessment of the game? You've fallen 12 points short of the premiers, but some of the statistical information would suggest that you are lucky to be that close. Now, that's debatable. How do you assess the way the game unfolded for the team?
Well, we're still going to do our review this morning of the game, so listen to what the coaches sort of, the themes of the game there. But, yeah, like, obviously there were some statistics that were, you know, quite big in Richmond's favour that, you know, we need to, you know, we can't be relying on, you know, winning games of footy if we're going to allow teams to have 66 inside 50s or, you know, plus, you know, 30 plus contested possessions on us. So, you know, we didn't get the result we wanted. We were in a lot of parts of the game, we remained competitive, which is great. So we're just going to keep trying to build on those sort of facets of the game. And, you know, hopefully the results can come sooner rather than later.
What you've been very good doing with us, Dylan, over the last couple of years is giving us perspective about how the team's travelling and educating us on this journey under a coaching transition. For the Essendon fans out there, how do you think you're tracking as a team at the moment?
Look, I think we're tracking okay in terms of how our improvement, you know, in our journey to become one of the premier teams in the competition. You know, we're not getting the results that we'd like at this point in time, and, you know, it's understandable for the club to be receiving criticism and our Essendon fans to be disappointed with how we're going at the moment. But, you know, when you're working so hard at trying to get better and improve, the results don't come, you know, straight away or immediately after that work. You know, there's a bit of a delayed effect. So look, we're going to stick at what we're trying to do. We've made a lot of progress with a lot of players and the way that we're trying to play the game at Essendon, and we're going to stick the course. And, you know, it's not just a one season that will define our journey. It's going to be, you know, the seasons coming ahead as well. So we'll keep trying to improve every day, every week, regardless of the result.
Now, a couple of months ago, when the interim coaching position of the Melbourne Victory was filled by Grant Brebner, we spoke to him and he said, no interest in being the long-termer, not a problem, I'm happy with my job. And then we spoke to him again about a month ago, perhaps, and it started to turn the conversation. And yesterday, he was appointed as the coach full-time, legitimately, of the Melbourne Victory Football Club. And we've been able to track him down again today on The Breakfast Club. Brebs, good morning. Congratulations.
Halfie, Whitey, thanks very much, boys. And went straight with the hard... Well, it's not a question yet, but you've gone straight in straight away, haven't you?
Well, that's what we do here. straight from the jugular. But it did change. Your tone changed. The way you spoke changed from the start to midway through, and now obviously you are the coach. Did you feel yourself changing through the journey?
Look, just to clarify, lads, yes, absolutely. When I first took over, I did rule myself out, and that's exactly how I thought. I didn't at that point look any further than what I was trying to do at that time, and that was get through these five games and start building the club.
Yep.
During the process of those games, I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved working with players. I loved the challenges that were getting thrown my way. And of course, you know, I started thinking internally, could I do it? And every time I thought, yes, but I kept it to myself. And then obviously when the dust settled and I came out at the other end, you know, I thought, yes, I'd absolutely love to do it. And, you know, the feedback from the players as well was great. And, I put my hand up. And I think underlying, you know, when I spoke to people about it, every one of them said it, that have been managers in England, and they said, look, you might never get this opportunity again. Grab it. Which is, you know, I put my hand up and thankfully I got it.
No, well, we spoke about it earlier this morning and even yesterday when the news was bubbling around that you were going to get the job. And we thought it was a fabulous appointment because one of the key reference points, I reckon, for Victory fans has been a real connection and someone in that role, your role now, of understanding the club and the people and the fans and the game and all that. And I'm sure that was a part in one of the reasons why you were such a prominent figure for that role.
Yeah, and I get that, and I know it's an easy, it's not a sell, you know, because I am, you know, obviously, and I have been a player at this football club. I know what it takes to win championships. I know how much it means to win championships to the members, the fans, the staff. They've got one of their own now in charge. I can't guarantee success, but they will absolutely know that everything we are doing will be to make sure that we are in the best position possible to get success, and that's the recruitment, which, you know, has to be thoroughly done. We failed at that this year. Signing the right players, leaders, and players that will take this club forward, and, you know, that's already started.
What's your first job? What's the first thing you want to do, Grant, to sort of steer the ship back in the right direction? Is there a player in mind? Is there what will you be looking at doing?
Yeah, no, there is. Like I said, even during the interim role, we were collating a lot of data on players because, as I said, recruitment is going to be a massive part for us. So that's already started. It didn't just start yesterday. It had been going for a while. So we've identified players. We're having discussions. I was up in the middle of the night last night, 3 in the morning, having a Zoom call with a player. So all these processes to get players in, yes, we've got challenges around COVID and how we get them here, but we want to hit the ground running. So the biggest thing at the moment is getting that squad together and making sure that we are going to be competitive.
How big a set challenge is it? How big a build is it to build it back up to what it should be or could be, the Melbourne Victory? Because 6 wins in a season is a pretty woeful return for a club that size.
Yes, absolutely. It's a challenge. It's a big challenge. It's an exciting challenge. It's a lot of clubs are going to, you know, we're in a fortunate position that we can sit back still and identify who we want and target them and go for them. There's going to be a lot of clubs in the next, you know, week to 2 weeks that are going to lose a lot of their players because of the landscape, because of the CBA and the salary cap coming down. So while it's tough, we're obviously in a good position because we can target who we want and then start those discussions rather than worrying about who we're going to lose right now. It's positive from our perspective and we just need to land a few.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.